asleep on the wall. She gently touches them and can feel their peaceful sleep. A soft wind is blowing, rustling the old curtain from time to time. A significant rustling, like some parable. She's wearing a long blue dress, a dress she wore somewhere a long time ago. Its hem swishes as she walks. The shore is visible beyond the window, and you can hear the sound of waves and someone's voice. There's a hint of the sea in the breeze. Small white clouds are etched against the azure sky. And it's summer. Always it's summer. Nakata carried the three thick files downstairs. Oshima was at the counter talking to one of the patrons. When he saw Nakata, he grinned. Nakata gave a polite bow in return, and Oshima went back to his conversation. Hoshino was in the reading room all the while, deep in a book.
"Mr. Hoshino?" Nakata said.
Hoshino laid his book down and looked up.
"Hey, that took a while. You all finished?"
"Yes, Nakata's all finished here. If it's all right with you, I was thinking we can leave pretty soon."
"Fine by me. I'm nearly finished with this book. Beethoven just died, and I'm at the part about the funeral. Man, what a funeral. 25,000 Viennese joined the procession, and they closed all the schools for the day."
"Mr. Hoshino?"
"Yeah, what's up?"
"I have one more favor to ask of you."
"Shoot."
"I need to burn this somewhere."
Hoshino looked at the files the old man was carrying.
That's a lot of stuff. We can't burn it just anywhere. We need a dry riverbed or someplace."
"Mr. Hoshino?"
"Yeah."
"Let's go and find one, then."
"Maybe this is a stupid question, but is that really so important? Can't we just chuck it somewhere?"
"Yes, it's very important, and we have to burn it all. It has to turn into smoke and rise into the sky, and we have to watch it to make sure it all burns."
Hoshino stood up and stretched.
"Okay, let's find a big riverbed. I have no idea where to look, but I'm sure Shikoku's got to have at least one, if we look long enough."
The afternoon was busier than it had ever been. Lots of people came to use the library, several with detailed, specialized questions. It was all Oshima could do to respond and to run about collecting materials that had been requested. Several items he had to locate on the computer. Normally he'd ask Miss Saeki to help out, but today it didn't look as if he'd be able to. Various tasks took him away from his desk, and he didn't even notice Nakata leaving. When things settled down for a moment, he looked around, but the strange pair was nowhere to be seen. Oshima walked upstairs to Miss Saeki's study. Strangely, the door was shut. He knocked twice and waited, but there was no response. He knocked again.
"Miss Saeki," he said from outside the door. "Are you all right?"
Gently he turned the knob. The door was unlocked. Oshima opened it a crack and peered inside, and saw Miss Saeki face down on the desk. Her hair had tumbled forward, hiding her face. He didn't know what to do. Maybe she was just tired and had fallen asleep. But he'd never once seen her take a nap. She wasn't the type to doze off at work. He walked into the room and went over to the desk. He leaned over and whispered her name in her ear, but still no response. He touched her shoulder, then held her wrist and pressed his finger against it. There was no pulse. Her skin retained a faint warmth, but it was already fading away. He lifted her hair and checked her face. Both eyes were slightly open. She looked as if she was having a pleasant dream, but she wasn't. She was dead. A trace of a smile was still on her lips. Even in death, she was graceful and dignified, Oshima thought. He let her hair fall back and picked up the phone on the desk. He'd resigned himself to the fact that it was only a matter of time before this day came. But now that it had, and he was alone in this quiet room with a dead Miss Saeki, he was lost. He felt as if his heart had dried up.
"I needed her," he thought. "I needed someone like her to fill the void inside me. But I was unable to fill the void inside her. Until the bitter end, the emptiness inside her, was hers alone."
Somebody was calling out his name from downstairs. He felt as if he had been hearing it. He'd left the door wide open and could hear the sounds of people bustling around. A phone rang on the ground floor. He ignored it all. He sat down and gazed at Miss Saeki. "You want to call my name?" he thought. "Go right ahead. You want to call on the phone? Be my guest." Finally, he heard an ambulance siren. It seemed to be getting closer. In a few moments, people would be rushing upstairs to take her away. Forever. He raised his left arm and glanced at his watch. It was 4:35. 4:35 on a Tuesday afternoon. "I have to remember this time," he thought. "I have to remember this day, this afternoon, forever." "Kafka Tamura," he whispered, staring at the wall. "I have to tell you what happened, if you don't already know."
43. With all my baggage gone, I can travel light now, forging on deeper into the forest. I focus only on moving forward. No need to mark any more trees. No need to remember the path back. I don't even look at my surroundings. The scenery's always the same, so what's the point? A canopy of trees towering above thick ferns, vines trailing down, gnarled roots, lumps of decaying leaves, the dry, sloughed-off skins of various insects, hard, sticky spiders' webs, and endless branches, a veritable tree-branch universe. Menacing branches, branches fighting for space, cleverly hidden branches, twisted, crooked branches, contemplative branches, dried up, dying branches. The same scenery repeated over and over. Though with each repetition, the forest grows a bit deeper. Mouth tightly shut, I continue down what passes for a path. It's running uphill, but not so steeply, at least for now. Not the kind of slope that's going to get me out of breath. Sometimes the path threatens to get lost in a sea of ferns or thorny bushes. But as long as I push on ahead, the pseudo-path pops up again. The forest doesn't frighten me anymore. It has its own rules and patterns, and once you stop being afraid, you're aware of them. Once I grasp these repetitions, I make them a part of me. I'm empty-handed now. The can of yellow spray paint, the little hatchet, their history. The rucksack's gone too. No canteen, no food, not even the compass. One by one, I left these behind. Doing this gives a visible message to the forest. I'm not afraid anymore. That's why I chose to be totally defenseless. Minus my hard shell, just flesh and bones, I head for the core of the labyrinth, giving myself up to the void. The music that had been playing in my head has vanished, leaving behind some faint white noise like a taut white sheet on a huge bed. I touch that sheet, tracing its outline with my fingertips. The white goes on forever. Sweat beads up under my arms. Sometimes I can catch a glimpse of the sky through the treetops. It's covered with an even, unbroken layer of grey clouds. But it doesn't look as though it's going to rain. The clouds are still, the whole scene unchanging. Birds in the high branches call out clipped, meaningful greetings to each other. Insects buzz prophetically among the weeds. I think about my deserted house in Nogata. Probably it's all shut up now. Fine by me. Let the bloodstains be. What do I care? I'm never going back there. Even before that bloody incident occurred, that house was a place where lots of things had died. Correction. Were murdered. Sometimes from above me, sometimes from below, the forest tries to threaten me, blowing a chill breath on my neck, stinging like needles with 1,000 eyes, trying anything to drive this intruder away. But I gradually get better at letting these threats pass me by. This forest is essentially a part of me, isn't it? This thought takes hold at a certain point. The journey I'm taking is inside me. Just as blood travels down veins, what I'm seeing is my inner self, and what seems threatening is just the echo of the fear in my heart. The spider's web, stretched taut over there, is the spider's web inside me. The birds calling out overhead are birds I've fostered in my mind. These images spring up in my mind and take root. As if I'm being shoved from behind by some huge heartbeat, I continue on and on through the forest. The path leads to a special place, a light source that spins out the dark, the place where soundless echoes come from. I need to see with my own eyes what's there. I'm carrying an important, sealed personal letter, a secret message to myself. A question. Why didn't she love me? Don't I deserve to have my mother love me? For years, that question's been a white-hot flame burning my heart, eating away at my soul. There had to be something fundamentally wrong with me that made my mother not love me. Was there something inherently polluted about me? Was I born only so that everyone could turn their faces from me? My mother didn't even hold me close when she left. She turned her face away and left home with my sister without saying a word. She disappeared like quiet smoke. And now that face is gone forever. The birds screech above me again, and I look up at the sky. Nothing there but that flat, expressionless layer of grey cloud. No wind at all. I trudge along. I'm walking by the shores of consciousness. Waves of consciousness roll in, roll out, leave some writing, and just as quickly, new waves roll in and erase it. I try to quickly read what's written there, between one wave and the next, but it's hard. Before I can read it, the next waves washed it away. All that's left are puzzling fragments. My mind wanders back to my house, to the day my mother left, taking my sister with her. I'm sitting alone on the porch, staring at the garden. It's twilight in early summer, and the trees cast long shadows. I'm alone in the house. I don't know why, but I already knew I was abandoned. I understood even then how this would change my world forever. Nobody told me this. I just knew it. The house is empty, deserted, an abandoned lookout post on some far-off frontier. I'm watching the sun setting in the west, shadows slowly stealing over the world. In a world of time, nothing can go back to the way it was. The shadow's antennae steadily advance, eroding away one point after another along the ground, until my mother's face, there until a moment ago, is swallowed up in this dark, cold realm. That hardened face, turned from me, is automatically snatched away, deleted from my memory. Trudging along in the woods, I think of Miss Saiki. Her face, that calm, shadowy smile, the warmth of her hand. I try imagining her as my mother, leaving me behind when I was 4. Without realizing it, I shake my head. The picture is all wrong. Why would Miss Saiki have done that? Why does she have to hurt me, to permanently screw up my life? There had to be a hidden, important reason, something deeper I'm just not getting. I try to feel what she felt then and get closer to her viewpoint. It isn't easy. I'm the one who was abandoned after all. She's the one who did the abandoning. But over time, I take leave of myself. My soul sloughs off the stiff clothes of the self, and turns into a black crow that sits on a branch high in a pine tree in the garden, gazing down at the four-year-old boy on the porch. I turn into a theorizing black crow. It's not that your mother didn't love you, the boy named Crow says from behind me. She loved you very much. The first thing you have to do is believe that. That's your starting point. But she abandoned me. She vanished, leaving me alone where I shouldn't be. I'm only now beginning to understand how much that hurt. So how could she do that if she really loved me? That's the reality of it. It did happen, the boy named Crow says. You were hurt badly, and those scars will be with you forever. I feel sorry for you, I really do. But think of it like this. It's not too late to recover. You're young, you're tough, you're adaptable. You can patch up your wounds, lift up your head, and move on. But for her, that's not an option. The only thing she'll ever be is lost. It doesn't matter whether somebody judges this as good or bad. That's not the point. You're the one who has the advantage. You ought to consider that. I don't respond. It all really happened, so you can't undo it, Crow tells me. She shouldn't have abandoned you then, and you shouldn't have been abandoned. But things in the past are like a plate that's shattered to pieces. You can never put it back as it was, right? I nod. You can never put it back as it was. He's hit the nail on the head. The boy named Crow continues. Your mother felt a terrible fear and anger inside her, okay? Just as you do now. And that is why she had to abandon you. Even though she loved me. Even though she loved you, she had to abandon you. You need to understand how she felt then, and learn to accept it. Understand the overpowering fear and anger she experienced, and feel it as your own. That way you won't inherit it and repeat it. The main thing is this. You have to forgive her. That's not going to be easy, I know. But you have to do it. That's the only way you can be saved. There's no other way. I think about what he said. The more I think about it, the more confused I get. My head's spinning, and I feel as if my skin's been ripped away. Is Miss Sayaki really my mother? I ask. Didn't she tell you that theory is still functional? The boy named Crow says. So that's the answer. It's still a functioning hypothesis. That's all I can tell you. A working hypothesis until some good counter-evidence comes along. You got it, Crow says. And I have to pursue that hypothesis as far as it'll take me. That's it, Crow replies pointedly. A theory that still doesn't have any good counter-evidence is one worth pursuing. And right now, pursuing it's the only choice you have. Even if it means sacrificing yourself, you have to pursue it to the bitter end. Sacrifice myself? That certainly has a strange ring to it. I can't quite grasp it. There's no reply. Worried, I turn round. The boy named Crow is still there. He's right behind me, keeping pace. What sort of fear and anger did Miss Sayaki have at that time? I ask him as I turn back around and walk on. And where did it come from? What kind of fear and anger do you think she had? The boy named Crow asks in return. Think about it. You've got to work that one out yourself. That's what your head's for. So I do just that. I have to understand it, accept it, before it's too late. But I still can't make out that delicate writing left on the shore of my consciousness. There's not enough time between one wave and the next. I'm in love with Miss Sayaki, I say. The words slip out naturally. I know that, the boy named Crow says curtly. I've never felt that before, I go on. And it's more important to me than anything else I've ever experienced. Of course it is, Crow says. That goes without saying. That's why you've come all this way. but I still don't get it. I'm stumped. You're telling me my mother loved me very much. I want to believe you, but if that's true, I just don't get it. Why does loving somebody mean you have to hurt them as much? I mean, if that's the way it goes, what's the point of loving someone? Why the hell does it have to be like that? I wait for an answer. I keep my mouth shut for a long time, but there's no response. So I spin round. The boy named Crow's gone. From up above, I hear the flap of wings.
You're totally confused.
Not long afterwards, the two soldiers appear. They're wearing fatigues of the old Imperial Army. Short-sleeved summer uniforms, gaiters and knapsacks. No helmets, just caps with peaks, and some kind of black face paint. Both of them are young. One of them's tall and thin, with round, metal-framed glasses. The other one's short, broad-shouldered and muscular. They're sitting on a flat rock. Neither one of them looking as though he's about to spring into battle. Their Arisaka rifles are on the ground at their feet. The tall soldier seems bored and is chewing on a stem of grass. The two of them look perfectly natural, as if here is where they belong. Unperturbed, they watch as I approach. There's a small, flat clearing around them, like a landing on a staircase. "Hey," the tall soldier calls out cheerfully. "How are you doing?" the brawny one says with the smallest of frowns. "How are you?" I greet them in return. I know I should be amazed to see them, but somehow it doesn't seem weird at all. It's wholly within the realm of possibility. "We were waiting for you," the tall one says. "For me?" I ask. "Sure," he replies. "No one else is coming out here, that's for sure." "We've been waiting a long time," the brawny one says. "Not that time's much of a factor here," the tall one adds. "Still, you took longer than I'd expected. You're the two guys who disappeared in this forest a long, long time ago, right?" I ask. "During maneuvers." The brawny soldier nods. "That's us." "They searched everywhere for you," I say. "Yeah, I know," he says. "I know they were looking for us. I know everything that goes on in this forest. But they're not going to find us, no matter how hard they look. Actually, we didn't get lost," the tall one says. "We ran away. Not running away so much as just stumbling onto this spot and deciding to stay put," the brawny one adds. "That's different from getting lost." "Not just anybody can find this place," the tall soldier says. "But we did, and now you have too. It was a stroke of luck, for us at least. If we hadn't found this spot, they would have shipped us overseas," the brawny one explains. "Over there, it was kill or be killed. That wasn't for us. I'm a farmer originally, and my buddy here just graduated from college. Neither one of us wants to kill anybody, and being killed's even worse. Kind of obvious, I'd say." "How about you?" the tall one asks me. "Would you like to kill anybody or be killed?" I shake my head. "No, neither one, definitely not." "Everybody feels like that," the tall one says. "Or the vast majority, at least. But if you say, 'Hey, I don't want to go off to war,' the country's not about to break out in smiles and give you permission to skip off. You can't run away. Japan's a small country. So where are you going to run to? They'll track you down so fast it'll make your head spin. That's why we stayed here. This is the only place we could hide." He shakes his head and goes on. "And we've stayed here ever since. As you said, from a long, long time ago. Not that time's a major factor here. There's almost no difference at all between now and a long, long time ago." "No difference at all," the brawny one says, waving something away with his hand. "You knew I was coming?" I ask. "Sure thing," the brawny one replies. "We've been standing guard here for a long time, so we know if somebody's coming," the other one says. "We're like part of the forest." "This is the entrance," the brawny one says, "and we're guarding it. And right now, the entrance happens to be open," the tall one explains. "Before long, though, it'll close up. If you want to come in, now's the time. It doesn't open up all that often." "We'll lead the way," the brawny one says. The path's hard to follow, so you need someone to guide you in. If you don't come in, then go back to where you came from, the tall one says. It's not all that hard to find your way back, so don't worry about it. You'll do fine. Then you'll return to the world you came from, to the life you've been living. The choice is entirely yours. Nobody's going to force you to do one or the other. But once you're in, it isn't easy to go back. Take me inside, I answer without a moment's hesitation. Are you sure? The brawny one asks. Someone's inside I have to see, I say. At least I think so. Slowly, the two of them get up off the rock and shoulder their rifles. They exchange a glance and walk on ahead of me. You must think it's strange that we still lug around these heavy lumps of steel, the tall one says, turning round. They're worthless. Never had any bullets anyway. They're kind of a sign, the brawny one says, not looking back at me. A sign of what we left behind. Symbols are important, the tall one adds. We happen to have these rifles and soldiers' uniforms, so we play the part of sentries. That's our role. Symbols guide us to the roles we play. Do you have anything like that with you? The brawny one asks. Something that can be a sign? I shake my head. No, I don't have anything. Just memories. The brawny one says. Memories, eh? That's okay, doesn't matter, the tall one says. Memories can be a good symbol, too. Of course, I don't have any idea how well memories will stand up, how long they'll last. Something that has a form or shape is best, if you can manage it, the brawny one says. It's easier to understand. Like a rifle, the tall one says. By the way, what's your name?
Kafka Tamara, I answer.
Kafka Tamara, they repeat as one.
Weird name, the tall one says.
You can say that again, the brawny one adds.
After this, we walk in silence down the path.
44. They took the three files to a riverbed along the highway and burned them. Hoshino had bought lighter fuel and doused the files before setting them ablaze. Then he and Nakata stood silently by, watching each page become engulfed in flames. There was barely a hint of wind, and the smoke rose straight up, losing itself among the low-hanging grey clouds.
"So we can't read any of these papers?" Hoshino asked.
"No, we're not supposed to," Nakata replied. "I promised Miss Saeki we wouldn't, and my job is to keep that promise."
"Yeah, keeping promises is important," Hoshino said, wiping sweat from his forehead. "It would be nice if he had a shredder, though. That would make it a lot easier. Copy shops have big shredders. You can rent pretty cheaply. Don't get me wrong, I'm not complaining. It's just kind of hot to make a bonfire at this time of year. If it were winter, that'd be another story."
"I'm sorry, but I promised Miss Saeki I'd burn it all, so that's what Nakata has to do."
"Okay, then. I'm in no rush. A little heat's not going to kill me. It was just a, what you call it, a suggestion."
A cat sauntering by paused to watch, a skinny, brown-striped cat whose tail was bent slightly at the tip. A personable cat, by the look of it. Nakata badly wanted to talk to it, but decided he'd better not, since Hoshino was with him. The cat wouldn't be able to relax unless they were alone. Besides, Nakata wasn't at all confident he could speak to cats as he used to be able to. The last thing he wanted was to blurt out something weird and frighten the poor creature. Before long, the cat grew bored watching the bonfire, stood up and padded away. A long while later, after the burning of the files was complete, Hoshino stamped the ashes into dust. The next strong wind would scatter the remains. The sun was almost setting by then, and crows were flying back to their nests.
"Nobody's going to read it now," Hoshino said. "I don't know what was written in it, but it's all gone. A bit of shape and form has disappeared from the world, increasing the amount of nothingness."
"Mr. Hoshino?"
"What's up?"
"I have a question I'd like to ask."
"Fire away."
"Can nothingness increase?"
Hoshino puzzled this one over for a while.
"That's a tough one," he admitted. "If something returns to nothing, it becomes zero, but even if you add zero to zero, it's still zero."
"I don't understand."
"I don't really get it either. Thinking about those kind of things always gives me a headache.
So maybe we should stop thinking about it.
Fine by me, Hoshino said. Anyhow, the manuscript's all burned. All the words in it have disappeared. It's gone back to nothing. That's what I wanted to say.
That's a load off Nakata's mind.
So this more or less wraps up what we need to do here, right? Hoshino asked.
Yes, we've almost finished what we need to do, Nakata said. All that's left is to close the entrance again.
That's pretty important, eh?
It is. What's opened has to be shut.
Well, let's get to it. Strike while the iron is hot and all that.
Mr. Hoshino?
Yeah?
We can't do it now.
Why not?
It's not time yet, Nakata said. We have to wait for the right time to shut the entrance. Before that, I have to get some sleep. Nakata's so sleepy.
Hoshino looked at the old man.
Wait a sec. You're not going to pass out for days on end again, are you?
I can't say, but it may turn out like that.
Can't we take care of business before you zonk out? Look, once you shift into sleep mode, things kind of come to a halt.
Mr. Hoshino?
What's up?
I wish we could shut the entrance first. That would be wonderful. But I have to get some sleep first. I can't keep my eyes open any more.
Your battery's all fizzled out, are they?
I suppose. It took longer than I thought to do what we needed to do. All my energy's gone. Would you take me back to where Nakata can get some sleep?
No problem. We'll get a taxi and go back to the apartment. Then you can sleep like a log if you want.
Once they'd settled into the taxi, Nakata started to nod off. You can sleep as much as you like when we're in the apartment, Hoshino said, but hang in there until we get home, okay?
Mr. Hoshino?
Yep.
I'm sorry to have put you to so much trouble, Nakata murmured vaguely.
Yeah, I guess you have, Hoshino admitted. But nobody asked me to do it. I tagged along of my own free will. Like volunteering to shovel snow. So you can relax on that score.
If you hadn't helped me, Nakata wouldn't have known what to do. I wouldn't have finished even half of what I had to do.
Well, if you put it that way, I guess it was worth the effort.
I'm very grateful to you.
But you know what? Hoshino said.
What?
I have a lot to thank you for, too, Mr. Nakata.
Is that right?
It's been about 10 days since all this began, Hoshino said. I've skipped work all that time. The first couple of days I got in touch with them and asked for some time off, but right now I'm sort of AWOL. I probably won't get my old job back. Maybe if I get down on my knees and apologize, they might forgive me. But it's no big deal. Not to brag or anything, but finding another job won't be hard. I'm a great driver and a good worker, so I'm not worried about that, and neither should you be. What I'm trying to say is that I don't have any regrets about being with you. These past 10 days has been a lot of bizarre stuff going on. Leeches falling from the sky, Colonel Sanders popping up out of thin air, hot sex with this drop-dead gorgeous philosophy student, swiping the entrance stone from that shrine. A lifetime's worth of weird stuff packed into 10 days. It's as if we've been doing test runs on a roller coaster or something.
Hoshino stopped here, thinking how to go on.
But you know what, Gramps?
Yes.
The most amazing thing of all has been you, Mr. Nakata. You changed my life. These past 10 days, I don't know, things look different to me now. Stuff I never would have given a second glance at before seems different. Music, for instance. Music I used to think was boring really gets to me now. I feel as if I have to tell somebody about this or I'll burst. Somebody will understand what I've gone through. Nothing like this ever happened to me before. And it's all because of you. I've started to see the world through your eyes. Not everything, mind you. I like how you look at life, so that's why it happened. That's why I've stayed with you through thick and thin, why I couldn't leave you. It's been one of the most meaningful times I've ever had in my life. So there's no need for you to be thanking me, not that I mind it. I should be thanking you. All I'm trying to say is you've done me the power of good, Mr. Nakata. Do you know what I'm saying? But Nakata wasn't listening any more. His eyes were shut, his breathing regular, and he slept. What a happy-go-lucky guy, Hoshino said, and sighed. Hoshino lifted the old man in his arms, carried him up to the apartment, and put him to bed. He took off Nakata's shoes, but he left his clothes on and covered him with a light quilt. Nakata squirmed a bit, then settled down as usual, on his back, facing the ceiling. His breathing was quiet, and he was still. "Bet we're in for another 3 days sleepathon," Hoshino thought to himself. But that's not how things turned out. Before noon the next day, Wednesday, Mr. Nakata was dead. He died peacefully in his sleep. His face was as calm as always, and he looked as if he was just sleeping, only not breathing. Hoshino shook the old man's shoulders and called his name, but there was no mistaking it. He was dead. Hoshino checked his pulse. Nothing. And even put a hand mirror next to his mouth, but it didn't cloud over. He'd stopped breathing. In this world, at least, he was never going to wake up again. Alone in the room with the corpse, Hoshino noticed how, very gradually, all sounds disappeared. How the real sounds around him steadily lost their reality. Meaningful sounds all ended up as silence. And the silence grew, deeper and deeper, like silt on the bottom of the sea. It accumulated at his feet, reached up to his waist, then up to his chest. He watched as the layers of silence rose higher and higher. He sat on the sofa and gazed at Nakata's face, trying to accept the fact that he really was gone. It took him a long time to accept it. As he sat there, the air began to feel strangely heavy, and he could no longer tell if his thoughts and feelings were really his. But there were a few things he started to understand. Maybe death would take Nakata back to the way he used to be. When he was alive, he was always good old Nakata, a not-so-bright, cat-talking old man. Maybe death was the only road back to being the normal Nakata he'd talked about. "Hey, Gramps," Hoshino said. "Maybe I shouldn't say this, but if you have to die, this isn't such a bad way to go." Nakata had passed away calmly in his sleep, most likely not thinking of anything. His face was peaceful, with no signs of suffering, regret, or confusion. Very Nakata-like, Hoshino concluded. But what his life had really meant, Hoshino had no idea. Not that anybody's life had more clear-cut meaning to it. What's really important for people, what really has dignity, is how they die. Compared to that, he thought, how you live doesn't amount to much. Still, how you live determines how you die. These thoughts ran through his head as he stared at the face of the dead old man. But one critical thing remained. Someone had to close up the entrance stone. Nakata had finished everything he'd set out to do, except that. The stone was right there, at Hoshino's feet, and he knew that when the time came he had to roll it over and shut up the entrance. But Nakata had warned him that if you mishandled it, the stone could be very dangerous. There had to be a right way of turning the stone over, but also a wrong way. If you just powered it over, that could screw up the entire world. "I can't do anything about your having died, Gramps, but you've left me in a real fix here," Hoshino said, addressing the corpse, which of course didn't respond. There was also the question of what to do with the body. The normal response would be to ring up the police or the hospital and have them take it. 99% of the people in the world would have done exactly that, and Hoshino wanted to. But the police were hunting for Nakata in connection with that murder case, and getting in touch with the authorities at this point would definitely put Hoshino, who travelled with him for the past 10 days, in a precarious position. The police would haul him off and grill him for hours. Explaining everything that had happened was the last thing he wanted to do, plus there was the fact that he was no fan of law enforcement. If he could avoid having anything to do with policemen, so much the better.
And how the hell do I explain this apartment? He wondered. An old man, dressed up like Colonel Sanders, lent us the place, said he'd prepared it specially for us, and that we could use it as long as we liked. Would the police really buy that? Colonel Sanders? Is he with the U.S. Army? No, you know, the Kentucky Fried Chicken guy. You must have seen their billboards, right, Detective? Yeah, that's the guy. Glasses, white goatee. He was a pimp working the back alleys of Takamatsu. He got a girl for me. Explained stuff like that, and the police would call him an idiot and give him a swift punch to the head. The police, Hoshino concluded, not for the first time in his life, are just gangsters who get paid by the state. He let out a deep sigh. What I've got to do, he thought, is get out of here right now, as far away as I can. I can make an anonymous call to the police from a payphone at the station, give them the address here, say that somebody's died, then catch a train back to Nagoya. They'll never connect me to the case. The old man died a natural death, so the police won't launch some investigation. They'll hand over the body to his relatives, and there'll be a simple funeral, end of story. Then I'll go to my company, bow and scrape in front of the president. It'll never happen again, I swear. I'll work hard from now on. Whatever it takes to get my old job back. He started packing, cramming a change of clothes into his bag. He put on his Junichi Dragon's cap, pulling his ponytail through the opening at the back, and his dark green sunglasses. Thirsty, he got a Diet Pepsi from the fridge. As he leaned back against the fridge and drank, he noticed the round stone next to the sofa. He went into the bedroom and looked at Nakata's corpse one more time. He still didn't look as though he were dead. He looked as if he was quietly breathing, and Hoshino half expected him to suddenly sit up and say, "Mr. Hoshino, it's all a mistake. Nakata's not really dead." But he didn't. Nakata was most definitely deceased. There weren't going to be any miracles. The old man had already crossed the Great Divide. Pepsi in hand, Hoshino stood there, shaking his head. "I can't just go off and leave the stone behind," he thought. "If I did, Mr. Nakata won't be able to truly rest in peace. He was such a conscientious type, always making sure things were done just right, and he would have finished this final task if his batteries hadn't cut out." Hoshino crushed the empty aluminium can and tossed it in the bin. Still thirsty, he went back to the kitchen and popped open another Pepsi. "Mr. Nakata told me how he wanted, if only one time, to be able to read," Hoshino remembered. "He said he wanted to go to a library and to be able to choose any book and read it. But he died before he could make that dream come true. Maybe now that he's dead, he's gone on to another world where he's become a normal Nakata and can read. As long as he was in this world, though, he never could. In fact, his final act on Earth was quite the opposite, burning up writing, sending all those words on the pages off into the void. Ironic, that, when you think about it. Which being the case, though," Hoshino thought, "I need to fulfill his final wish. I've got to close the entrance. I wasn't able to take him to the cinema or to the aquarium, so it's the least I can do for him now that he's gone." He drained his second Pepsi, went to the sofa, crouched down, and tried lifting the stone. It wasn't so heavy. Not exactly light, either, but it didn't take all that much to lift it. About as heavy as when he and Colonel Sanders had stolen it from the shrine. About as heavy as the kind of stones used to weigh down pickles as they ferment. "That means right now it's just a stone," Hoshino thought. "When the stone's acting as an entrance, it's so heavy you have to kill yourself to pick it up. But when it's light like this, it's just an ordinary stone. Something extraordinary has to happen first for the stone to become as heavy as it did and change into the entrance stone. Like lightning striking all over town or something." Hoshino went to the window, opened the curtain, and gazed up at the sky from the veranda. The sky was the same as the day before, a mass of drab grey clouds. It didn't look as if it was going to rain, though, much less thunder. He pricked up his ears and sniffed the air, but everything seemed the same as yesterday. "Steady as she goes" seemed to be today's theme for the world. "Hey, Gramps," he said aloud to the dead man, "I guess I just have to wait here with you for something out of the ordinary to happen. What the hell that could be, I have no idea, or even when it might take place.
Plus it's June, and your body's going to decay and start to stink pretty soon. I know you don't want to hear this, but that's nature for you. And the more time that passes, and the later I get in touch with the police, the worse it'll get for me. I mean, I'll do whatever I can, but I just wanted you to be aware of the situation, okay?
There was no reply, of course. Hoshino wandered around the room.
That's it. Colonel Sanders might get in touch. He'd know what to do with the stone. Him you could always count on for some warm-hearted, practical advice.
But no matter how long he stared at the phone, it just sat there, a silent, unnecessarily introspective object. Nobody knocked on the door, not a single letter arrived, and nothing out of the ordinary happened. The weather stayed the same, and no bright ideas came to him. One expressionless moment after another ticked by. Noon came and went, the afternoon calmly reeling into twilight. The hands of the electric clock on the wall skimmed smoothly over the surface of time like a whirligig beetle, and on the bed Mr. Nakata was still dead. Hoshino didn't feel at all hungry. He had a third can of Pepsi and dutifully munched some crackers. At 6 p.m. he sat on the sofa, picked up the remote and switched on the TV. He watched the NHK evening news, but nothing caught his attention. It had been an ordinary day, a slow news day. The announcer's voice started to get on his nerves, and when the program was over he turned off the TV. It was getting darker outside, and finally night took over. An even greater stillness and quiet enveloped the room.
"Hey, Gramps," Hoshino said to Nakata. "Could you get up, just for a few minutes? I don't know what the hell to do, and I miss your voice."
Naturally, Nakata didn't reply. He was still on the other side of the divide. Wordlessly, he continued as he was, dead. The silence grew deeper, so deep that if you listened carefully, you might very well catch the sound of the earth revolving on its axis. Hoshino went out to the living room and put on the Archduke Trio. As he listened to the first theme, tears came to his eyes. Then the floodgates opened.
"Jeez," he thought, "when was the last time I cried?"
He couldn't remember.
45. As advertised, the path from the entrance on is hard to follow. In fact, it's pretty much given up trying to be a path. The further we go, the deeper and more enormous the forest gets. The slope becomes a lot steeper, the ground more overgrown with bushes and undergrowth. The sky has just about disappeared, and it's so dim under the canopy that it feels like twilight. Thick spider's webs loom up all over the place, and the air's thick with the smell of plants. The silence gets even deeper, as though the forest is trying to reject this invasion of its territory by human beings. The soldiers, rifles slung across their backs, seem oblivious as they easily cut through openings in the thick foliage. They're amazingly fast as they slip past the low-hanging branches, clamber up rocks, leap over hollows, neatly avoiding all the thorns. I scramble to keep up and not lose sight of them as they forge ahead. They never check to make sure I'm still there. It's as though they're testing me, to see how much I can handle. I don't know why, but it almost feels like they're angry with me. They don't say a word, neither to me nor to each other. They're focused only on walking. Without exchanging a word, they take turns in the lead. The black barrels of the rifles on their backs swing back and forth in front of me, as regular as metronomes. It starts to get hypnotic after a while. My mind begins to wander, as if it's slipping on ice to somewhere else. But I still have to concentrate on keeping up with their relentless pace, so I march on, the sweat pouring off me now. "We're going too fast for you," the brawny soldier finally turns round and asks. He's not out of breath at all. "No, I'm fine," I tell him. "I'm hanging in there." "You're young, and look as if you're in good shape," the tall one comments without looking round. "We know this path really well, so sometimes we go too fast," the brawny one explains. "So don't be shy, okay? Just say the word and we'll slow down. But understand, we don't want to go any slower than we have to. You know what I'm saying?" I'll let you know if I can't keep up, I tell him, forcing myself not to breathe too hard so they won't have any idea how tired this is making me. Do we have far to go? No, not really, the tall one answers. We're almost there, the other one adds. I'm not sure I believe him. As they said, time's not much of a factor here. So we walk on for a while without talking, at a less blistering pace than before. It seems that they've finished testing me. Are there any poisonous snakes in this forest? I ask, since it's been worrying me. Poisonous snakes, eh? The tall one with the glasses says without turning round. He never turns round when he talks, always facing forward, as if something absolutely critical's about to leap out in front of us at any moment. I never thought about it. Could be, the brawny one says, turning to look at me. I haven't seen any, but there might be some. Not that it matters, even if there are. What we're trying to say, the tall one adds casually, is that the forest has no wish to harm you. So you don't need to worry about snakes or anything, the brawny one says. Feel better now? Yes, I reply. No other here. Poisonous snakes or mushrooms, venomous spiders or insects is going to do you any harm, the tall soldier says, as always without turning round. Other? I ask. I can't get a mental picture of what he means. I must be tired. An other. No other thing, he says. No thing's going to harm you here. We're in the deepest part of the forest, after all. And no one, not even yourself, is going to hurt you. I try to work out what he means. But what with the exhaustion, sweat, and the hypnotic effect of this repetitive passage through the woods, my brain can't form a coherent thought. When we were soldiers, they used to force us to practice ripping open the enemy's stomach with a bayonet, the brawny one said. You know the best way to stab someone with a bayonet? No, I reply. Well, first you stab your bayonet deep into his belly, then you twist it sideways. That rips the guts to ribbons. Then the guy dies a horrible, slow, painful death. But if you just stab, without twisting, then your enemy can jump up and rip your guts to shreds. That's the kind of world we were in. Guts. Oshima told me once that intestines are a metaphor for a labyrinth. My head's full of all kinds of thoughts, all intertwined and tangled. I can't differentiate between one thing and another. Do you know why people have to do such cruel things to other people? The tall soldier asks. I have no idea, I reply. Neither do I, he says. I don't care who the enemy is. Chinese soldiers, Russians, Americans. I never wanted to rip their guts open. But that's the kind of world we lived in. And that's why we ran away. Don't get me wrong, we weren't cowards, either of us. In fact, we were pretty good soldiers. We just couldn't put up with that rush to violence. I don't imagine you're a coward, either. I really don't know, I answer honestly. But I've always tried to get stronger. That's very important, the brawny one says, turning in my direction again. Very important. To do your best to get stronger. I can tell you're pretty strong, the tall one says. Most kids your age wouldn't make it this far. Yeah, it's pretty impressive, the brawny one pipes in. The two of them come to a halt at this point. The tall soldier takes off his glasses, rubs the sides of his nose a couple of times, then puts his glasses on again. Neither one's out of breath, or has even worked up a sweat. Thirsty? The tall one asks me. A little, I reply. Actually, I'm dying of thirst. My canteen gone along with my rucksack. He unhooks the canteen from his waist and hands it to me. I take a few gulps of the lukewarm water. The liquid quenches every pore of my body. I wipe the mouth of the canteen and hand it back. Thanks, I say. The tall soldier nods silently. We've reached the ridge, the brawny soldier says. We're going to go straight to the bottom without stopping, so watch your footing, the tall one says. I follow them carefully down the tricky, slippery slope. We get about halfway down, then turn a corner and cut through some trees, and all of a sudden, a world opens up below us. The two soldiers stop and turn round to look at me. They don't say a thing, but their eyes speak volumes. This is the place, they're telling me. The place you're going to enter. I stand there with them and gaze out at that world. It is a basin neatly carved in the natural contours of the land. How many people might be living there? I have no idea. But there can't be many. The place isn't big enough. There are a couple of roads, with buildings here and there along either side. Small roads, and equally small buildings. Nobody's out on the roads. The buildings are all expressionless, built less for beauty than to withstand the elements. The place is too small to be called a town. There aren't any shops, as far as I can see. No signs or bulletin boards. It's like a few buildings, all the same size and shape, happen to come together to make up a little community. None of the buildings have gardens, and not a single tree is along the roads. It's as though, with the forest all around, there's no need for any extra plants or trees. A faint breeze is cutting through the woods, making the leaves of the trees around me tremble. That anonymous rustling makes ripples on the folds of my mind. I rest a hand against a tree trunk and close my eyes. Those ripples seem to be a sign, a signal of some sort, but it's like a foreign language I can't decipher. I give up, open my eyes, and gaze out again at this brand new world before me. Standing there, halfway down the slope, staring down at this place with two soldiers, I feel those ripples shifting inside me. These signs reconfigure themselves, the metaphors transform, and I'm drifting away, away from myself. I'm a butterfly, flitting along the edges of creation. Beyond the edge of the world, there's a space where emptiness and substance neatly overlap, where past and future form a continuous, endless loop. And hovering about, there are signs no one has ever read, chords no one has ever heard. I try to calm my ragged breathing. My heart still isn't back in one piece, but at least I'm not afraid. Without a word, the soldiers start walking again, and silently I follow. As we go further down the slope, the town draws closer. I see a small stream running alongside a road, with a stone wall as an embankment. The beautiful, clear water gurgles pleasantly. Everything here is simple and cozy. Slim poles with wires strung between them are dotted about the area, which means they must have electricity. Electricity. Out here. The place is surrounded by a high green ridge. The sky is still a mass of grey clouds. The soldiers and I walk down the road, but we don't pass a single person. Everything's very still, not a sound to be heard. Maybe they're all shut up inside their homes, holding their breath, waiting for us to go away. My companions take me to one of the dwellings. Strange thing is, it's the same size and shape as Oshima's cabin, as if one was the model for the other. There's a porch at the front, and on it a chair. The building has a flat roof with a stovepipe sticking out the top. There's a plain single bed in the bedroom, neatly made up. The only differences are that the bedroom and living room are separate from each other, and there's a toilet inside, and the place has electricity. There's even a fridge in the kitchen. A small, old-fashioned model. A light hangs from the ceiling. And there's a TV. A TV. For the time being, you're supposed to stay here till you get settled, the brawny soldier says. It won't be for that long. For the time being. As I said before, time isn't much of a factor here, the tall one says. The other one nods in agreement. Not a factor at all. Where could the electricity be coming from? They look at each other. There's a small wind power station further into the forest, the tall one explains. The wind's always blowing there. Got to have electricity, right? No electricity and you can't use the fridge, the brawny one says. No fridge and you can't keep food for long. You'd manage somehow without it, the tall one says. Though it sure is a nice thing to have. If you get hungry, the brawny one adds, help yourself to whatever's in the fridge. There isn't much, I'm afraid. There's no meat here, no fish, coffee or spirits, the tall one says. It's hard at first, but you get used to it. But you do have eggs and cheese and milk, the brawny soldier says. Gotta have your protein, right? They don't make those other things here, the tall one explains.